welcome our speaker tonight, Mike from Primary Purpose in Bel Air, Maryland.
Good evening, everybody.
Good evening.
My name is Michael Schoaf, and I'm an alcoholic. My home group is Primary Purpose Speakers Group. It's called Primary Purpose. We meet in Bel Air, Maryland on Tuesdays and Thursdays. Tuesdays we have a speaker meeting. We have a 10-minute speaker that speaks on the primary purpose of AA, followed by a 45-minute main speaker. And then on Thursdays we do a Breaking Apart the Big Book meeting. And that's just what we do. Average now, I think we're making it through about two sentences a week. And it's just, it's a really cool experience. So that's where I'm from. It was crazy. Jeff had asked me to come up here and do this, and I said, sure, you know, no problem at all. He'd come down to my home group, which was Harbor City, you know, at the time when I was living in Baltimore. And, so I said, yeah, I'll come up there, feet first, no problem. And, so I had like seven or eight guys planning to come here, and then I texted him the other day. I said, where's the address for this place? And he sent me the address. And I said, holy nuts, man, we are, this was like 3 hours away. So I came, you know, I came with a couple really awesome men today. You know, I'm not sure what's better, being up here at the car ride here at home. Sometimes it's definitely a flip of a coin. I my journey getting sober took place behind the lights of a dashboard a whole lot more than they did in the hour that we stand here today. I can definitely share that. And my sobriety date, I have about 50 or 60 of them. I'll tell you, I'm not a first nighter. I'm not even a first decader. I'm not even a second decader. My first meeting with Alcoholics Anonymous, my first sobriety date was April 14th of 1997. They went really quick in that first year of being around, but kept changing them up. But my current sobriety date is September 7th, 2017. Now, I've learned a lot of lessons in the time that I've been coming around AA. I have a lot more experience of what not to do than I do on what to do. But I've also learned a lot of valuable lessons along the way about what this journey of recovery is and what it isn't. You know, I'll just tell you, as a result of these 12 steps and coming to AA, I have found a God that has absolutely transformed my life. A powerful, powerful relationship. And on a daily basis, I'm telling you, I can feel closeness. I can feel gentleness. I can feel the harmony of them. I can make mistakes and not necessarily be or feel like a failure. I can engage in responsibilities and commitments. And I just had this amazing opportunity. I live on the front lines of AA. I sponsor a number of men. I help many others. I'm involved in the work. And I can just tell you, I like to tell you that right up front, that I've had a powerful transformational experience in Alcoholics Anonymous. And that experience has been the connection and the discovery and the relationship that I've developed with the God of my understanding. My story has a tendency to get a little dark. So I like to throw that out up front. You know, I don't really know what we're going to talk about tonight. We'll see where the Spirit leads me on this one, but I definitely just want to throw that out. It's good to be here. I wasn't expecting to be outside either. This is a little different too. And it's kind of neat. Like, we make our own back rows. I mean, even when they're not far enough back, I just kind of thought I'm a back row guy. So if I was here, I would be right in those lounge chairs. Let me just tell you, like, I used to stand up here and I used to tell a lot of people about what my story was like. You know, where I came from. And I remember it was one time I was telling someone about how I came from this home and it was really how poor we were, right? And it felt like we were poor when I was growing up. It really did. But after the meeting, this guy came up to me and said, boy, you ain't poor. Let me tell you what poor is. You know? And I had other people that looked at me and they'd never even seen an ounce of anything close to the way I lived. And all that it created was this difference between us, right? And so somewhere along this journey, I kind of stopped telling so much about what my life looked like. And I started to tell a little bit more about kind of how life felt, right? And a little bit of, not so much about how much I drank or what I drank, but what alcohol did for me. You know what I mean? I'd say there came a point, what makes me an alcoholic today is that when I put a drink in me, I have no idea when this journey is going to end. I have no idea. I cannot stop upon anybody's request. I can't even stop on my own will or accord. It's on. And then once it finally gets out of my system, I cannot, without any accuracy, predict what I'm going to put it in me again. And it usually will require a set of circumstances where it really shouldn't happen for me to drink again. And then that's when I'll drink. But I cannot, with any accuracy, tell you when I'm going to drink, how much I'm going to drink, or what's going to happen. I tell you, I'm up here today, and I swear I stand here sober by the grace of God alone. Nothing I have done do I take credit for being sober today for. It is God's intervention into my life. Somehow, some way, God found suit to let me have a sober breath. Because how in the world I woke up today and haven't taken a drink yet still blows my mind some days. It's what I do. I still have quite the affinity for whiskey. I'm telling you, I love whiskey. I'm going to be flat out. And I'm also a believer that I'm not really done drinking until the day you put me in the ground. It's not the most popular sentiments in Alcoholics Anonymous, but I've also spent 20 years running around here telling you I was done drinking. And I spent 20 years telling you how much I just can't stand booze. But yet, when I get to a place where I'm completely empty inside, it's the only thing I love. And if you look at the actions in my life, I'll tell you this. If love is for better or for worse, in sickness and in health, till death do us part, it's the only covenant I've ever made. And I'm a married man with children. And I sure did not honor that statement to my wife. But I sure held it true, too, with Whiskey Boy. And, yeah, it's funny. But let me just tell you, like, when I was 14 years old, I had my first drink. You know, and I what happened for me is I was a kid who grew up in, you know, I grew up in a very structured home, and we did a lot of church, and we did a lot of things, and it always felt like I was being taught the right way, you know. When we had DARE in school, and we had those types of things, it didn't take a whole lot. I mean, like, yeah, that's what I'm learning at home, you know. Like, what the world taught was kind of what my parents taught. And what I learned in other places was kind of what happened in my home. The main outlet that I had growing up was I played soccer, I played baseball, I played handball. Handball is not one I used to tell anybody about, but it's true. If you don't know what it is, I'll tell you later. But I played handball and also, but I got really good at soccer. I played all over the East Coast. And, by the time I got to high school, I was on the varsity team my first few days of tryouts before school started my freshman year. And I'll never forget, man, I went out to this party my freshman year of high school. And, it was my first one, man. And I was suited up right. Like, I asked my parents for permission to go. They said, sure, be home by 10. You know, I had my mid-thigh cargo shorts on, you know, the tube socks up to my knees. You know, we were ready to roll 1993. And, I had the pressed Izod shirt, you know, with the three buttons at the top, of the little alligator lacrosse shirt, whatever. And I was out this party, man. I'll tell you what, the one thing I can tell you is walking into this environment, it was a lot like walking into a meeting like this. You ever gone to a diner and you look at a table and you're a group of people and you're like, they're from AA. You know what I mean? Like, you see a book club, you'll see a sports team, and you'll see a family reunion. Then you're like, yeah, they're drunks. That's what it is. And it's kind of like what it was like, man. I mean, we had like white dudes with dreads at this party. I'd never seen anything like this. I mean, we had, you know, people with their clothes ripped in half because they chose to. The glory of God was not descending. I'll tell you, that's about all I had to compare it to. But I went into this place nervous as could be, and all I could tell you was I was fine when I was there. Hey, you okay, buddy? Yeah, I'm fine. I'm fine. And, walked around this party for about 5 minutes, and I'm 14 years old, and finally, these guys are asking me if I want to take a drink, and I'm all done telling everybody, no, I mean, I learned, I know, don't drink, liquor, beer, no good, smoking pot, no good, but somewhere in this moment, like, they asked me if there, you know, is there anything I wanted to do, and I saw these guys in the back corner, and it's rafters like this, there was all kinds of stuff going on, but there was these guys in the back, and they were on these hay bales, and they had this yellow funnel. And it didn't look like drinking. I didn't see it in DARE. You know what I mean? I've never experienced these guys were having a good time, and it didn't appear to me anything illegal was going on. So I said, yeah, I'll try that. So I went back to this corner, and I'll tell you what. They put three Milwaukee's beasts into this little funnel, and they gave me strict instruction. And I can tell you what happened, man. They were telling me, we're going to lift this up. Don't swallow. Just let it go down. Make sure that you, you know, just open your chest up or whatever. And, I mean, as they're telling me, I'm really trying to retain it. And, man, they stood up, and I'm still trying to process what I'm doing, and they just lift this freaking yellow funnel up, and I'm going to tell you what, I just opened my throat, and it went down, and my freaking ears started ringing, and my chest froze, and my eyeballs were about to pop out. I had beer getting ready to shoot out my nose, and I sucked it in, I mean, like, midair, and it wasn't because I'm a good alcoholic, it's because I didn't want to make a mistake, you know what I mean? Like, my ego was a lot more dominant than my alcoholism at that time, and, man, I sucked this stuff in, man. I tell you what, I hit those beers. They went down. These guys clapped for me. They applauded, and I thought I did something good, and then all of a sudden, I was back to being empty. And then about 20 minutes goes by, and I'm going to tell you what happened, folks. I was born again by the spirit of Ethel. You know what I mean? Ethyl alcohol was introduced to my body, and I was transformed. I woke up. I woke up. I had just, for the first time in my life, experienced something that I had never experienced any time, any place before. I found a peace in my skin. I found a comfort in life. I had a complete understanding of who, what, when, where, why, and how. And I didn't have any words for it. I didn't need to explain it. It was just understood. It was my first spiritual experience I've ever had. And from that day until this day, I'm going to tell you, alcohol never was, is, or will be my problem. It became my solution immediately. To life. The only thing alcohol was a problem for was everybody else who was in my life. And then that would soon become me being the problem for them. But another story. The emphasis I want to make is alcohol became everything I needed to be who I needed to be. If I was doing good, it made it better. If I wasn't doing good, it fixed that problem. If it wasn't going to fix it, at least I enjoyed not doing good. You know what I mean? I was okay. Who needs to be happy? We're just going to be wherever we are. Pass the bottle. And that drink would go on and on and on and on and on. And I tell you what, I would come in, and what began to happen in my life was problems began to occur. Challenges began to happen. You know, my drinking got a little bit aggressive. I don't know that I necessarily was alcoholic at that point. But I'll tell you what, alcoholism found its match in me. And I found a solution, right? I began to drink for years and years, and it was funny how I would drink. You know what I mean? It changed everything about the way I lived. You know? If I came out here, whatever you were drinking, you know, whatever you were listening to, that's what I liked. If I went to the West End of Hagerstown, I drank Pabst Blue Ribbon and I listened to, you know, classic rock. If I went, you know, to the opposite side of town, I drank Colt 45 and I was into hip hop. You know what I mean? Like, it all depended, and I went wherever I needed to go, and I became whoever I needed to be to meet the crowd. I learned early on that I could not drink successfully at the age of 14, 15, 16 without being 21 years old, just on my own volition. It required a lot of planning, thought processes, you know, it required a lot of manipulation. And so my life began this course of forget about me, my entire identity, my entire life, my entire focus in my life was built around who I am with the drink, right? And how do I get the next? And how do I do it? I took it to the extremes, guys. I think over the course of between the time that I was, you know, 14 years old right then, I went through all kinds of stuff. And I went through several DUIs. I went through all these different circumstances of accidents and injuries. A dozen vehicles and other types of situations. I got married, actually, to a wonderful woman. I finished college. I had four kids. I got some really good jobs. I've owned a couple businesses. I've done some really good stuff, and I had a phenomenal number of years drinking throughout the process. Like, I can tell you, man, it got awful, but from day one till the last day, like, my intention coming here was never to stop drinking. That just wasn't anywhere on my radar. I just didn't understand the point of that. Like, maybe there's an alternative way here, right? Maybe we're just going to get some things situated. Maybe we just need to get some things leveled out here. And then Once that's situated, then we'll figure it out from there, right? But I never really had those intentions coming into Alcoholics Anonymous any given time. What I did come into Alcoholics Anonymous for was so that I didn't go to jail, so that I could get my girlfriend to let me back into the house, so the wife wouldn't throw me out the door, so that someone would continue to pay my cell phone bill. So I could go down the list of everything, but you know, from a very young age, I got to this point where if you were in my life, no matter how much I may or may not want to love you, the truth is you're a resource. That's who you are. You serve a function, and as long as you continue to serve that function, we're cool. If you choose to become bold and want to sever yourself from me, I desire to cut your brake lines, burn your home, and find another friend. That's where my heart and my mind go with people. Let's just call it what it is. I don't have friends. I have people that allow me to do what I want more, and I have people that don't. Those are not my friends. These are. I have people that provide me with anything that I find satisfactory because all I can think about is me. Right? And I spent a lot of years coming into Alcoholics Anonymous in search of relief, but never really looking for recovery, if that makes sense. And I'm not saying that nobody told me what recovery was. I just wasn't looking for it. You know, and today I can step back here. I can tell you the biggest difference, and this is in AA. This is just me. My sponsor told me, nice, share your experience, not your opinions, boy. But this is kind of one of my opinions that is kind of my experience, right? You like how we do that? When I come in here, like, relief comes when I come in here and I start to do the things that are really difficult for me to do in life. And those things range, right? Coming in here, doing things like maybe showering every day, showing up to work on time, showing up in a meeting and fulfilling a commitment, you know, being a chairperson and showing up there. Like, there's just a lot of these commitment things and disciplines, paying my bills. Those are very difficult things to do. But when I do them consistently, there's a little bit of relief that comes into my life. And it sometimes feels like I'm doing better. But all it is relief, because the moment that wears off, I need to find something else to do to feel a little bit better. I've even done that with working with guys. I've come into Alcoholics Anonymous, thought I was rolling in recovery, and all I was doing was running around using people like a drink. You know, and then I go get in my car after I've just, you know, been running around with these three guys, and I'm left on my own for a half an hour drive home, and my mind's running like 100 miles an hour. And I got to find something else to do to get relief. But as long as I continue to do the hard things, I felt that I was starting to get relief. Recovery began to happen in my life over this past year and a half when I started to consistently do the things that I was scared to death to do. The things I was really, really afraid to face. That's kind of been probably the biggest awareness that I've really seen. So I tell you guys, what ends up happening for me in my life is I run around AA, I come in and out, I use everybody up, and I do all this. I do some good talking sometimes. I even, you know, kind of grabbed a hold of some pretty decent principles and learned to live by them, kind of. But no matter what I do in here, I always come to this point where I step back, life's pretty decent. I assess the situations in my life, and I determine what we need to do next, right? That's where it always begins, and that's where it always ends. There's financial crisis at home. You know what? I need to go out and make more money. The kids aren't being able to get where they were. The wife's unhappy. You know what? We just need to make sure that we spend more time here. Look, guys, you probably best if you find another sponsor. I'm going to really be occupied at home a lot more this month. You know what, guys? I'm really not going to be able to make this commitment. I tell you what, let's just kind of make it loose. This will be my home group, but maybe every third week I'll be there, okay? Just got responsibilities in life, you know? And that becomes how I begin to live. My recovery becomes about what I'm doing, and it has completely disconnected from what my relationship to God is, and what my relationship to myself is, and what my relationship to you is. It's gone. And I just become a guy who's running around chasing, fixing, doing, building, creating, whatever it is that my kingdom should look like. And God's kingdom is gone. And inevitably, I build my kingdom, and it starts to crumble, And I say, holy smokes, God help. And he says, you build it, you fix it. All right? That's kind of what it feels like. And then it crumbles, and then I blame you, and I blame God, and I blame man, and I blame these things. And I realize, rarely have we seen a person fail who has thoroughly followed our path. And if I really take a look back, I can tell you I've had all this time in and out, in and out, in and out, in and out, in and out of Alcoholics Anonymous. I've had all this time in all these sobriety dates, and the only thing that I have not done consistently over all these years that has been going on consistently for the last year and a half of my life is I've thoroughly followed a path. And I'll tell you, the first year of my recovery was not a splendid year at all. It was an awful year. It was a tough year, right? The second year's been pretty cool, but it doesn't like look wonderful all the time, you know? So we'll get into this. I'll kind of share with you a little bit like how I ended up landing in September 7th here, because we're getting about halftime. We need to get sober. And, but let me just tell you, consistently following a path, consistently putting principles into my life, and consistently applying honesty to all things is something that was just a foreign concept for me. That by the grace of God, I was blessed with men that just showed me how to do it. I was equipped with men who were properly armed with facts about themselves. They not only won my confidence, but taught me how to just tell the truth. And I tell you, if there's anything I could ever wish for anyone coming into AA, is find somebody that knows how to tell the truth. And just stay close to them. Because it is definitely not something that comes natural to a guy like me. You know what I mean? Because I am always fine. I am always great. And I am always just doing wonderful. And I always have a plan. And it's never what I tell you. That's my default mode. The biggest difference, and I'm not telling you those things have gone away because I still have them. You know? It's just, I'm aware enough to know what those are and not act on them today. Right? So, my drinking goes on and on. You know, there's periods of time where people dealt with me, tolerated me, whatever. It finally just got to a point, guys, where I swear the only reason that my drinking really came to an end is because at the latter stages of my drinking, once I start drinking, within a few weeks, there's about a dozen sheriffs there every day. And I'm in padded rooms. I'm not even in detoxes anymore. Do you know what I mean? They have these medication lists for me like I'm schizophrenic. And I mean, I'm just nuts. That's what happens when I start to drink. That's what happens after a few weeks after I'm drinking. And one of these times, I went about 10 months and I was sober. And I picked up a drink. It was just a half pint of Evan Williams. And I thought, you know what? We're not going to start drinking. We're just going to take the edge off tonight. And that was my thought. So we did that. And we drank that half pint. I'm telling you what, the edge went right off. It went right off so well that I had a pint the next day. And that took the edge off so well, I had a pint and a half the next day. And that went so well that I just thought, you know what? We're just going to hold tight at a couple pints. And that went good for about 2 days. And then I had to go to work. And I thought, you know what? As long as I don't drink more than 2 pints at work, I think we'll be okay. And then that lasted about a week before. They don't take kindly to that in hospitality when you're drunk at work. So they, you know, they let me go, and then goes into the homeless. And then within a week's time from that, I've got restraining orders. You know, within less than a week's time of that, now I've got some real heavy activity going on it. You know, internally, emotional stuff, and popping a couple little Xanaxes in there with the whiskey, and it's sheer evil. And I remember this, man. I kind of came to this one point, and I just kind of felt like the end was coming near. And I just knew that I couldn't continue like this. I didn't know what to do. I knew that if I kept drinking, I knew that I was going to be locked away in a place that I couldn't get myself out of, and I wasn't going to be able to drink in there. I knew that there was something else that was possibly going to happen with repercussions physically here that could put me in a jail cell that would prevent me from being able to drink in there. And I knew that if I stayed out here, the options were coming down to probably either kill myself or just drink. You know, and just, I didn't even know where I was going. And I didn't have anybody left to turn to. So my wife, who has that wonderful restraining order, I thought maybe she'll help me. So I grab a handle of whiskey and I just start drinking and I head over there. And I walk into this house and I'm going to tell you what, you want to talk about some scared people. I walk in there and there was the steps. I mean, all my kids have their cell phones 911 ready. You know, she's not sure what to do. And I walked into her bedroom and I sat down on a chair and I said, I need help. She said, you do. And she said, why don't we go get you help? And I said, well, what are we going to do? And I don't know if I was hoping she was just going to say, just stay here and drink tonight or what. But she, you know what I mean? Like, possibly. But she said, no, get in the car. Get in the car. And so I said, well, take my truck, you know, because I had liquor in my truck. So she let me keep drinking. She drove my truck. We get to this hospital, we go inside, and then she says, you can go talk to him. And so I just went over to the lady, and I said, I'm here to get sober. For real. You know? And she said, you can't bring the liquor in here, you know? I said, well, I'll just wait out here, you know? So she said, nope, they brought me in. So Kizzy took the liquor, put it back to the truck. We went in, they took a look at me, drew my blood, did some things, and you know, they come back out and they inform her that and us that I have a 0.64 blood alcohol level and that I need to sit down and hang out for a while. And I said, okay. Sit down. That's what you want me to do. So I sat down and I went about 8 hours, folks. 8 hours in there before I start quaking and I start shaking. And I mean, it's like full bore quaking. And, you know, this thought hit me that maybe we overreacted. So I tried to leave this hospital. And the security decided that we were not going to leave this hospital, sir. So they brought me back into this hospital and they took me into a room to make sure I couldn't leave this hospital. And about another 8-10 hours goes by. And man, I'm full on it. And look, guys, what I'm telling you, this story I'm telling you is an exact copy-paste duplicate of the last 3 times that I've been into hospitals in the last 3 years before that. I start seizing up. I go out. They have to medically induce me into a coma. They come out. My wife has to sign advanced medical directives. They give me a 25% chance of living through withdrawal. Every form of treatment they're trying to give me, the body's not responding to. And that's where I'm at. And they put me down in this bed, and they whatever they do when they medically induce you into a coma. And a lot of this story I know because we had when I was in a rehab, we had to read these medical reports in front of a group because I was teaching the group how to get sober. And he said, I think this boy needs to read about himself. And so I wake up 2 days later. I come to. I start to rip this. They got a tube in my mouth. I got a catheter where the catheters go. I got a feeding tube up my nose. And I mean, I'm all wired up. And I start taking this thing off. And the nurses bum rush me in there. And beepers going off. And they pull all this stuff away. And they call me down. And they gradually assess me, take parts out. And then it seemed like a day, but it was probably like an hour. You know, Kizzy comes back in. And she says, Michael Schoaf, what do you want to do now? And I'll never forget this. This is September 6th. So I went in September 4th, September 6th. I'm sitting there, and I swear, this is like where my sobriety began, the journey that I'm staying before you today. Started right here. She said, where do you want to go next? What do you want to do? And I looked at this woman square in the eyes. I mean, I am way too sober for this kind of conversation. But I looked her square in the eyes and I just said, I just want a glass of whiskey. And I just told the truth. I didn't say, I don't know, honey, wherever you want me to go. Well, what do you think we should do? You know, I just want to get better and stop hurting. I will take a glass of whiskey and a handgun, and we'll see where this goes. That's what I'll take. I'd rather shoot you and drink the whiskey, but that's just where I was at. And I don't know where it came from, but I had the ability that day, that time, that place to just tell the truth. And something began to happen in me. And the truth just began to take over, is what happened. She said, well, then we're done, Michael Stephen Chope, and that began the beginning of my divorce and separation of my children. I mean, it all just went boom, you know? And at the end of it, I still didn't want to change my mind. I still wanted the whiskey. So I went off into this treatment center. You know, they shipped me off to a detox in Jersey, which was intense. And then, if anybody's from Jersey, I don't mean that personally. It's just an intense state. And then they sent me from Jersey down to Baltimore. And I'll tell you, here's the crazy thing. You know, I got a call from this. This is a true story. Like, this is how things began to happen. I got a call from this lady in this treatment center, and she says, Michael, this is Karen. I'm like, how in the world did Karen get my number? You know what I mean? Like, calling me in a detox facility. And she said, we want you to come back. Now, here's what I know. I was in this treatment facility before, and Karen was my therapist. This is the thought that's going through my head. Kizzy talked to Karen. Karen knows I'm getting divorced. Karen's always wanted to be with me. And Karen really sees this as an opportunity. I said, yes, Karen, I will come. And so I ended up in treatment. That's how I ended up in treatment. Because I thought a therapist wanted to marry me. I mean, how does this stuff work? Like, even if it would have happened, it would have been disastrous. But that's what my mind tells me, you know what I mean? And so I get into this treatment center, guys, and I walk back into the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous. I get to this treatment center, and man, I come in, I'm telling you, I am one like DEFCON 2. I do not want to be sober. I do not want to be in rooms of AA. Heaven forbid my first meeting would have been outside. Like, you know what I mean? I would have had something to say about that and something to say about this. And I would have told you, y'all are a bunch of flat ass. And I would have just kept going and going. And I just, all these people were like, hey, it's good to see you. Welcome back. Is it? Is it good to see me? Like, is it really? And I remember just having this distinct attitude. Just, I'd hear a person say, you know, you just, what went wrong? And I'd want to cut your brake lines again. Just anger, rage, deep seated evil rage just coming out of me. And, I'll tell you what happened. And it does. I pay attention to my own life today because there were a lot of people that said, man, I'm glad you're back. There were a lot of people that told me, you know what, Mike, you just need to work the 12 steps. Everything's going to get better. They're not lying. But there were a lot of people that said a lot of good things to me. And then I was venting to this one guy at a little habitat or something or other thing we were doing in the treatment center. And about, I was ready to burn the forest, guys. I can remember to this day how it felt. And this guy, bigger guy, but he was standing there, and I'm just telling him about how much I just can't stand this and this and this. And he says, you know what? I know exactly how you feel. I felt the same way, too. I said, oh, you did? Why don't you tell me about that, man? And this man, properly armed with facts about himself, told me what it was like in his own life to be ready to rip his skin off and everybody else is around him without a drink and without a God. And I'll tell you what happened. That man, in that conversation, it disarmed me. It disarmed me. And I began to follow this guy. And this guy, you know, all he asked me to do for a little bit was, he says, dude, just tell the truth. Don't take things that don't belong to you. And if you don't have anything nice to say, don't say it. Oh, no problem. 6 seconds later, that, you know what I mean? But you know what? It's amazing how just those three things will help reconnect you to the world. And he just began telling me these little things, and he began taking me through this process of the steps. And I'm going to tell you what happened, guys, is every day we would talk, and he would say, how are you? And I would tell him how I was, and he would nudge me to cut the BS out. And he'd say, how are you? How are you? And no matter what I said, he would always just bring it right down to fear. And he would bring it right down. So you don't believe that God can and will, huh? Yeah. You don't have a drink. You better get a God. You know what I mean? This man would just drive me in this. And I'm telling you, I would have called his nonsense nonsense, but I believed him because he was able to tell me about pain that sounded like mine. Right? He knew it. This man was able to be sick with me while he was being well. You know? And I remember asking him sometimes, so I bet you got a grand old life now, don't you? He's like, yeah. There's a few minutes of grand in my life, you know, and they would just threw me off, you know, and just the willingness for him to open up. And, but he began to drive me into this direction of you know, powerlessness for alcohol. That wasn't really the issue, right, with me. But I realized that I wasn't too certain that God could fix a drunk like me. I wasn't too certain I was really interested in a God fixing a drunk like me. I think I'm a little bit more interested in fixing my own self than having anybody else help me. And if you're helping me, all you're doing is getting me to a point where my ideas work. You know what I mean? Like, at the end of the day, that's it. And I'll tell you what happened is he began nudge me, and he just kept nudging me into this awareness of God and who I am. And I'll tell you, in steps 1 through 3, essentially what happened is I got a right relationship with God. This is really what ends up taking place here. And what happens for me on my third step experience is I get into this, so I'm living in this treatment center. It's broken into a bunch of like apartments, right? And everybody in these apartments have these little twin plastic mattresses. And he says, buddy, you're either going to get a God or you're going to die. That's what's going to happen. You know what I mean? And I'll tell you, getting a God was a little bit more worrisome for me than dying. But I don't know. I just knew. I don't know. Like, I thought, this dude's nuts. I'm going to try this, right? So I go into this thing, and we go through this first step, and he says, you know, I think it might be better for you to do this one by yourself rather than anybody that you think is going to misunderstand you, taking your opinions of other people into consideration here. And so he sends me off to my rehab. I go in this little room and I shut the door and I get in this, right? And I got the third step prayer. It's in the book. I've written one that's kind of like my own. And so I start doing this third step prayer. Now, folks, I do this third step prayer where I read it out of the book because even though I've written one, I'm afraid if I make a mistake, I mean, you know, the one I wrote, this will definitely cover me. And so I'm reading it, man. I tell you, I read it. I lift my hands and I read it, you know, because I learned that in church one day. And then I get down on my knees and I read it once. I laid down, like, well, I got that out. And then I did the same thing. I repeated the cycle with the one I wrote. And I do all these third steps. I probably did it 36 times. I'm not kidding you. And I'm waiting, like, for maybe a light to flicker. I'm waiting for something to happen. And nothing happens. So what ends up happening for me is I just kind of throw it on the ground. I'm like, I know it. I just know this is it. And I get on my bed, and I had these two pillows. There's not many stories I tell every time I talk, but this is one of them. I get on this my little bed, my little plastic mattress, and I take the one that's always under my head, and I put it under my head, and there's one I always keep between my knees when I sleep. And I put it next to me, and I slid to the side of this mattress. And I just looked into this pillow, and I just, in the depths of me, I just said, God, if you are there, I need you to come down and lay with me. And I need you to help me. You can have whatever you want for my life. You can have money, which I'm pretty much flying out the door faster than I can make it at this point, right? It's yours. I don't have a car anymore. That's all been repossessed. But you can have that whenever I get one. I promise I'll use it for your work. Women, I swear, Lord, I'll look at them as your kids and not objects. Guys, I promise I'll do my best to be your friend and not make them a resource, man. Look, whatever I want and don't want, just take it. Just take it. But I need you to come down and either get me sober or kill me. I just need you to do something. And I'm telling you, I don't know if you guys have ever had a hug with someone that you just haven't seen for decades that you love. And there's a touch, but there's all this stuff that floods through you, right? And I swear, like, I was laying there, man. It was like the arm of God just came around and just held me. And just grabbed a hold of me. And I just started to weep. I mean, I wept and I wept and I wept. And I'm going to tell you what happened that night was my life was full with two things, and it was terror and it was rage. That's what ran my life. I wanted to die, but I wanted to kill everyone else first. You know, I wanted to hide far away. All I want is to just drink and be alone. But I can't do that without getting arrested. I swear, I would get arrested in a homeless camp. Like, they would call the cops on me. Like, it's just, I can't even do it anywhere. But I want to hurt, and I want to kill, and I want to die, and and I sat there and I wept, and as I wept, and as that night went, man, terror and rage just became fear and anger. And they dropped. And I'm telling you what, I have 12 steps to work with fear and anger. All of a sudden, like, God just disarmed it, and all of a sudden, for the first time, I had willingness to tell the truth and trust this God. Like, I knew. And I went into this four step really quick. And I'll tell you what, the difference in this four step, I've done a lot of four steps, man. I've done a lot of performances for people. I think I probably made up more stuff just so I could look good on a four step than I could for anything else. Or I put stuff down, you know what I mean? Like, you know how you're supposed to say you got 2 weeks to do it? At the end of the day, you write it in the last 7 hours before your fifth step due. You know what I mean? Like, it's kind of one of those things. Like, I sat down and I would just write this stuff and I would just wait till the very last minute and I'd elaborate. Maybe nobody's ever had that experience, so if not, I apologize. But I would go through this journey, man. I'll tell you what began to happen in my life is that I started to like look at myself. I had this covering of God and I had all this stuff going on inside of me, and I just knew. Like, I knew God was gonna be okay. I knew He had me, right? I knew it was everything. I knew it was everything or nothing. And I just knew it. And I just began to put stuff on paper without abandonment. And it didn't matter if it was silly or stupid. Like, my sponsor will figure that out. You know what I mean? That's not my job. My job isn't to figure out what I need to do. My job is just to do. And my job is to run to God to learn how to be. I don't have willingness. God has it. I don't have faith. God has it. I don't have joy. God has it. You're never going to catch me around here. You see me in a good mood, it's because I'm getting what I want. You know, I don't have that stuff in me. God has it. And I'm telling you, I learned how to go to God and ask for it the right way. I learned how to let God have His purpose in me, and I start writing this stuff down. And what I have come to find out when I'm writing this four step, you know what, guys, is that I learned that end of the day, I had all these resentments towards Kizzy and these kids and all this stuff. And you know what? I never really loved this woman. I wanted sex, validation, and security. The rest of it, I don't want to listen to your hard day. I mean, I will if it gets me sex, validation, and security. But I realized that, you know what? What love is, I don't have. These kids, I don't really love these kids. What I want is to be seen as a good dad so that everyone will applaud me and my ego will be satisfied. But I sure don't want the responsibilities that come with stewarding a child of God. Right? I want them to be there and I want them to be happy doing what I want them to do, but I don't need their interrogations or their questions. I don't need them to wake up and need things while I'm drinking, right? What I love is a bottle, right? I'm doing this, and all of a sudden, I'm seeing that I love these things, and I don't love this, and what I'm seeing is that all I'm doing is I'm just scared, and the whole time I'm running this drink because I really don't believe that anybody can fix me, even God, that anybody can provide me what that drink does. And I go through it, and I'm telling you what, guys, I had this crazy four-step experience that just thrust me into an eight-step that I really didn't think could exist. And I went out and did these eight-step amends, and I went a nine-step amends, buddy. And I'm going to tell you, I was inspired. I remember I was at a couple of meetings, and I heard these people talk about going to their families, and their families were like, we just hope you get well, and we just want you to do good. Or like, Michael, you know, you're a great man. You've done well. We know you did the best you could. You were sick. We just, don't worry. Keep the money. Not what happened to me. Nobody told me to keep my money. I had some people that gave me addresses to send it to and didn't even want me to see me, but insisted the money. And the amount they told me I owed them was a lot more than I calculated with interest. I'll just tell you that. But you know what? I just began to do it. I just began to follow this through. And I'll tell you some of the hardest amends that I had in this journey, in this first year. Not only this, now I'm going through the divorce process. I'm filing bankruptcy, which, by the way, I thought would be cool, but my sponsor told me it's not a way to escape amends. So, I ruined that plan. But I am able to be a little more free today. It's cool. But I owe a lot of money there. There are tax issues. You name it, man. I had all this stuff, and I had all these amends, and I thought that those were going to be the tough ones, right? But money, what is money, man? Like, God has all the money in the world, dude. If God wants me to make $70,000-$80,000 this year, I can work for $10 an hour, and there's going to be $70,000 or $80,000 there. That's how it's going to work. If God wants me to make $10 an hour, and I make $50 an hour, somehow the other money's going to disappear. There's just going to be $10 an hour. You know, it's just all there, right? And I don't know, or somehow I was able to embrace that, but I thought these amends with my family were going to be easy, man. I tell you, I walked back in, my 14-year-old son, Isaiah, I remember going to see him and saying, "Hey, Isaiah, you know, buddy, I am really, thank you. I really screwed up in your life, buddy. I failed you in so many ways. I've mentally, emotionally, physically, spiritually have been abusive. I didn't show up for you when you needed me. I wasn't there to listen to you. I put you in compromising situations and all this, and I went through this long list of things of just how I really chose myself in the bottle over him. And I say, if there's anything I've left out, you know, he's 14 years old, right? If there's anything I've left out, feel free to let me know. And if there's anything I can do to make it right, let me know." And I'll never forget, man, I'm like 9 months sober. And this kid looks at me square in the eyes. And he says, "You know what, Dad? It's okay. I've accepted the fact that you're an alcoholic and you're just never going to be able to be a dad. And I've already found a new dad, so don't worry about me. But if you could get better for Judah, because he's still young and he could use you." And man, did I want to go and just tear into that, right? My journey of getting well, guys, is this. I go and I do these actions and I think, right on, I did the right thing, but you know what? It hurts. The only reason I don't owe more amends from that amends is because I kept my mouth shut out of fear of my sponsor. Mm-hmm. Really. Not because it was my idea. But I listened to him, and I listened to him talk, and I wanted to talk. Then you know when I get home, and I'm driving home, and I'm just pissed. And then I get home, how can you not understand? You know what I mean? Like, I've given this. All the stuff I said I didn't do, now I'm telling myself I did do. You know what I mean? Like, what's going on here? And I get home, and I sit down, and you know what? Here's the craziest part. Truth, right? I'm a little bit relieved that he has another dad because I'm not ready to take on that responsibility right now anyway. That's the truth. And if I really dig deep, I really don't have an interest in him. I just have an interest in him telling me I'm okay. And dude, I don't want to swallow that pill. But it's the truth. And guess what? I'm not going to live with that banner over my life, but I am going to let that speak. And when I do a 10-step, that is what's going to come out of my mouth when I talk to another human being. And when I go to God, I am going to admit that that's where I stand, and I'm going to ask him to change it. And I'll tell you, I just kept on going out. I'll tell you guys, about another 3 months goes by, 4 months goes by, and I'll never forget this, man. I'm driving home. I get home from work one day, and I get on my bed, and I go down and tie my shoes. And I don't really know. It's no different day than any other. But I go down and untie my shoes from work, and it's like 12:30, 1 o'clock in the morning, working in a hotel. And when I go to untie my shoes, this thought comes over me. And I begin to wonder, with curiosity, how my son's doing. How's Isaiah doing? It was so gentle. It was just so soft, right? And I just began to wonder, like, oh my God, I love my son. You know what I mean? Like, I'm a year sober, I love my son. Oh my God. You know, it just blew me away. Like, I could feel what it feels like to just love this kid. And to be curious about it, right? And, man, after that day, so many things started to happen, like, where, I'm telling you, like, my kids, like, I was like, hey guys, I have a great relationship with my youngest three now. Like, we were just out paintballing last week, and, you know, Kizzy, like, she's like not sure that we should get divorced right now anymore. I don't know if that's really the right move or not. My sponsor says I've done enough damage, let her have her opinions for a while, let her do what she wants to do. But like, she's kind of pumped the brakes on that. They're moving to North Carolina. I'm in Bel Air. I said, you want me to come with you? She said, that's not what I said. Just, you know what I mean? We're not ready for that, right? And, so my kids, like, I tell my kids, like, how if I come down with, see you guys? They're like, yeah, FaceTime's good. You know what I mean? I can take that as an attack, but the truth is, you know what I mean? Like, what I do is I get up and I just give everything I have to God. I have all these plans and these designs for my life, and all I know is that these are mine. They are not God's. And if they are, the one fold, right? But I just throw that before God. I throw that before another human being. I quit pretending like I'm some magical guy doing this thing because I'm some brilliant genius. It wasn't the wisdom of the ages that saved my butt. It was the truth that saved me. You know? And the truth is these 12 steps were the solution until they got me to God. And then God became the solution. Right? These 12 steps, this is not what the 12 steps are. These are simple, simple descriptions of the action we take and the change of heart that we acquire. Right? And I found this, and I'll tell you one last story, man. This is like one of my favorite stories about the reuniting of my family. My daughter, she's 13. Her name is Zion. And Zion, you know, she's all home by herself, and one night, and I could tell you guys so many amazing stories. Why did I wait this long to tell the kids stories? So she calls me up, and she's like, Dad, I'm home by myself. Mom's at work, and da-da-da-da. I said, well, is Mom coming home? She said, I think she's coming home. I'm not sure. I'm sad, and this, and da-da-da-da. And then she'd been having some trouble in school with, like, cutting herself and different things like that. It's some other issues too, way outside of what we're doing here. And so anyway, Kizzy calls me from work and says, you know, Michael, could you just go? I mean, living in Baltimore, right? Could you go? And they're in Virginia, Northern Virginia, hour and a half. Could you go and just hang out with Zion tonight? I'm feeling a little uncertain, right? I said, okay. So I get in my car and I start driving. And so Zion calls me. I'm about, like, you know, 30 minutes away from her house. And I'm driving, and she's like, Dad, Mom said you're coming, are you? I said, I am. She says, Dad, I think I started my period. I said, oh, you did? I said, is your mom coming home? She said, no. I said, why do you think that? And she started to tell me, and I said, that's what that is. And I said, well, what do we do? You know, I'm 40 years old, guys, right? And I'm panicking. I am panicking. So I'm like, okay. So I said, well, hold on. Let me focus, right? And I pull the car over, and I'm like, God, what do we do? What do we do? What do we do? And I'm like, we just go to the house. Let's just go to the house. Start there. So we start driving. And I don't know you, but I was just overcome with this, with, like, the solution. It intuitively came to me, right? So I stopped at the grocery store. I got tampons with the varieties of all kinds, pads. I got chocolate chip cookie dough ice cream. I went down the tea aisle, right, and I got this box of, like, it's like peach ginger stomach ache tea, right? I got that. And I got a 6-pack of ice cold Coca-Cola's in glass bottles. And I went to the house, and I came in. She was waiting for me at the door. And I gave her a hug and went upstairs, and she's like, this is a lot, Dad. I said, I'm an alcoholic. So she's like, I don't do ginger and peach. I said, okay. So we sat down, and she got on the phone with her mom and figured the pads and the tampons out. But we sat down, and we ate chocolate chip cookie dough ice cream, and we drank ice cold Coke until like 1 o'clock, 2 o'clock in the morning. And I tell you what, it was just an amazing time. And she's getting into some honorary stuff, but you know what? She calls me and she tells me about it. She tells me what she's up to. Kind of. Right? I've been here long enough. I know where it goes. But healed. Healed. So what did Alcoholics Anonymous do for me? It gave me that.
I have the most amazing relationship where God has entered in, given me love for children that I didn't have love for. Has melted us together, man. And my outsides, I can tell you all about it, but they don't matter an ounce to what God is doing with the softness and the anger